Revelation 15 is where we've left off. You may remember that in Revelation 15, John introduces the seven plagues, or the seven bowls of wrath. We've gone through the first seven seals. We've also looked at the seven trumpets, and now we have this third major symbol. We introduce these in Revelation 15, verses 1 and 2, and as we continue through the chapter, it's a short chapter, shortest chapter in the book. It has only eight verses, and after we finish up with this chapter in Revelation 16, we'll continue to deal with the seven bowls of wrath. But in 16, he gets a lot more specific. 15 is just kind of an introduction. We covered verses 1 and 2 last week. We'll read those and then start with new material, which is verse 3. And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having seven plagues, which are the last, for in them is finished the wrath of God. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that come off victorious from the beast and from his image, and from the number of his name, standing by the sea of glass, having harps of God. Now 3. And he says, continuing the thought, and they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are thy works, O Lord God, the Almighty, righteous and true are thy ways. Thou King of the ages, who shall not fear, O Lord, and glorify thy name? And that gets us into verse 4. Singing a song. This is something that we've already seen in the book of Revelation. We saw it earlier in Revelation chapter 5, verse 9. Singing a song is also something that we saw back in Revelation 14, verse 3. When we were way back in Revelation 5, we mentioned that the idea of singing not just a song, but singing a new song is, as you go back at the Old Testament, it was, I really don't like the word symbol, but it was a way of saying something has happened. There's been something positive, something good has occurred, and now we have this new song to mark that particular event. We have different examples of that, and we'll cite one. That would go back to Exodus chapter 15. You may remember that after Moses led or helped lead the people of Israel out of Egyptian bondage, they sang a song. Exodus chapter 15, it's most of the chapter. You could go back and look at verses 1 through 19 a little later if you like. But you have at that point Israel. When you think about them on the Red Sea, where are they? Israel. They left Egypt, got through the Red Sea, so where are they? They're on the other side of the sea, right? What happened to the Egyptians? Well, okay, they didn't quite make it. They got swallowed up by the sea. Well, now think about that and look at, once again, Revelation 15. He says, I saw another sign, great and marvelous. He got the seven angels. Verse 2, and I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire. Them that come off victorious from the beast. And they're standing where? By the sea. Well, you can see how that kind of calls back to the Old Testament story of Moses and the Egyptians. You know, they're by the sea. They got through it. Now they're by it. And you also see, as you look at the information there in verse 2, victorious from the beast. Well, did the Hebrew people have a beast?
They
were the beast. The Egyptians were. They were being chased by the beast. Yeah, that's what you meant. And they did have a beast. Were they victorious over the beast? Absolutely. So, John, as you go back and you look at this book, you begin to find all of these Old Testament allusions that we see time and time again. Now, there's something that I want to go back and look at as far as Exodus 15. If somebody pick up with just the first verse in Exodus chapter 15, verse 1. And as you're turning there, I've got a couple other things to say, so you will have time to get there. Who'd like to be a volunteer? Okay, Glenda. Now, when you think about the nation of Israel, they leave Egypt. Anybody recall about how many folks, estimates are that came out of Egypt? We're dealing with 10, 20? How many? We're thinking at least 1 million. Some would go upwards of 2 or 3 million. Now bear that in mind. You've likely got at least 1 million people, maybe 2 or 3 million. They've gotten to the other side of the Red Sea. Now this happens. Exodus 15, verse 1. Glenda? Okay, and then you can continue on with the song if you want to read through that chapter, which we're not going to do now. But that key point is in Exodus 15, verse 1. You have 1 million plus people. They get through the sea, and what do they start to do? They sing. Moses and the people of Israel. Can you imagine what 1 million voices would have been like?
Surrounded by the water.
Yeah, surrounded by the water. I mean, I have heard 4,000 or 5,000 people sing, and it's pretty awesome. But you put 1 million voices together, it is a really inspiring picture. We'll develop that thought in a minute, Don. Okay.
And this is Song of Moses. We can go back to chapter. It's not quoted exactly.
Right. You do have that. You've got two or three things sometimes that take place with that. Sometimes it's a translation issue. In this case, I don't think that that is what we're looking at. You have other situations where a person says, well, Don said, and I might attribute some things to you, but the words or the statement that I attribute to you, it may not be word for word. I'll go ahead and summarize some things, may add a couple of the details. So we've got the essence of what was said, and I think that's what we're dealing with here.
Even Jesus, when he basically quoted the Old Testament,
right.
He did not quote verbatim.
There are some, right, and some of that it's a translation issue. Sometimes he quoted from the Septuagint, which that was a translation that was a lot looser than we probably would be comfortable with using today. And that would explain some of those passages. And then there are some other passages where when you look at what Jesus did, he kind of pulled from two or three passages and compiles them all together. Then you have some other situations where you have people giving the essence of that. I saw something the other day that I'd never seen before as far as in print. Somebody had cited a Bible passage and then, comma, summary. They were trying to just give a summary statement from the passage instead of a verbatim quote. So we still do that. It's the same kind of thing today.
So basically, it's permissible to quote the intent of the passage. You don't have to worry about getting every word precisely the same.
But we do that today. What's the golden rule? Treat people as you want to be treated. Well, is that what it says?
No.
Is that the essence of it, though?
Yes.
Yes. So we do that same kind of thing today. You know, in the work situation, they're probably not going to go through all 10 rules that are posted by the time clock. They're going to say, okay, you know, this is it. Well, if you go back and you look at the quote-unquote fine print, okay. But it's a thing that man has done for a long time, and sometimes Bible writers did that. So depending on the circumstances, preachers sometimes paraphrase passages or give the essence of it. But we want to be always truthful and consistent with the text. So sometimes that's an acceptable way to do things, as we see from inspiration. In other cases, let's go back and, I mean, let's check it out word for word. Okay.
Well, yeah. So you can't analyze, some verses you can analyze word for word, but yeah, it's not always.
When you're going back and you're looking at quotes from the Old Testament, you always have to go back and pay a little extra attention to those passages and say, okay, is there a difference in the wording? Well, okay, in this situation, yes. Now, why is that? Is it because the Septuagint was being quoted? Is it because we have two or three passages that are being drawn together, and we have those passages being compiled in some kind of way? Or are we dealing with a translation issue? Or are we dealing with a situation where you've got a summary? So I would look at that as far as the answer on an individual basis and just say, what do we have here? And then, the Bible does recognize that there are times where you do have kind of a summation.
So the content is the same,
you're okay. Biblically, I mean, if God saw fit for inspiration to, in some cases, do the kinds of things that we talked about, and he has, then we're not in a position to say that he messed it up. But to go back and look at those cases one by one. All right, we've got this song being sung by probably a million plus people. Now moving forward to our day and time. What do we have in the church? We've still got saved people, do we not? We've got a day where God's people are to come together and worship. And now what happens with that praise? Still goes up. Now, I don't know how many people offer that praise to God. But it is different, radically different, from this perspective. When you think about what we had in Exodus 15, we have there people who are in the same general area. But now as we think about the church, the praise that ascends to God, where is it coming from? All over. Not just in one general area, not just from one country, but worldwide we have this praise. So this is the picture that we have in Revelation chapter 15. In eternity, of course, this praise is going to reach its climax. Now this is something that has come up a couple of times. It came up last week, and I'm going to deal with it today again. A lot of people, when they look at Revelation 15 or they look at some other passages in the book of Revelation, they instantly think, well, this is a reference to heaven. I've said before, my view of things, the way that I'm presenting this in class, is that we really don't have that much information about heaven anywhere in the Bible, and that includes the book of Revelation. When you look here at Revelation 15, a lot of people will say, well, hey, okay, this is people in heaven. We talked about Revelation chapter 6 and so forth, and they say, well, they're in verse 2. You've got the sea of glass that's mingled with fire. They've come off victorious from the beast, and now they're singing this song, and they're doing that in heaven. I don't think so. If we look at the Bible, how many passages do we need to prove a point? How many times does God have to say something before it's right and true?
Once.
I mean, just once. Now, people sometimes say, well, okay, I see that passage, but can you give me another one? That's just kind of the way that we think. But once is enough. So if we have one passage which says that saved people, when they die, don't go to heaven, that's enough. But I want to, since this comes up at various times in the book, I want to look at five passages as a class that in my mind are very, very compelling as far as the view that when people die, the saved go to their side of the Hadean realm, which is the paradise side where Jesus and the thief went, and then the unrighteous go to the side which is not pleasant. Both of those sides are also spoken of in Luke 16. Let's look at these one by one. We start with John 3. John 3, verse 13. Now this is a passage, of course, which was written by the same fellow who wrote the book of Revelation. And John makes a statement here that if we had only this passage in my mind, this would be sufficient. As we look at this verse, need to remember that it would have been written before Jesus went back to heaven. And I'll explain why this is important a little bit later. But this passage was written before Jesus went back to heaven or after? Book of John, when was it written? It was written after Jesus goes back to heaven. Okay. All right, now John 3, verse 13. Who would like to be your helper? All right, Scott.
No one has ascended into heaven except he who descended from heaven, the Son of Man.
Okay. Who, once again, remember that he's writing after the resurrection. Jesus is now back in heaven. And John says, how many people have gone up to heaven?
One.
Just one. The guy who came down. Now that passage to me seems pretty clear cut. When John says nobody's gone into heaven except the guy who came down, that's Jesus. I don't know how you get around that verse. But this is not the only one. We have, as I said, at least five passages in the New Testament that deal with this topic. And when we have these clear passages, a basic rule of Bible interpretation is when you have passages which may be a little more difficult, or in the case where you're dealing with passages that have symbolic language in the book of Revelation, do you use those less clear passages to somehow undo the clear passages, or do you take the clear passages and say, okay, this is the right information, so whatever is being taught over here in the obscure passage, we've got to interpret that more difficult information in light of the clear. Do we use the clear to interpret the obscure, or do we use the obscure to somehow reinterpret the clear?
We use the clear.
And John 3, verse 13 is a clear verse. Let's look at another passage, Acts 2. This is Acts 2, verse 34. Now, you may remember that Peter, day of Pentecost, you've got several people there, about 3,000 become Christians, and Peter, before he gets down to that part of the sermon on how to become a Christian, he says something about David. David had died about 1,000 years prior to this time. Also, just like with the book of John, Jesus at this point has gone back into heaven. Acts 1, now that he's back in heaven, we have some preaching. Let's see what he says in Acts 2:34, Steve.
For David ascended not into the heavens, but he saith himself, Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand.
Okay, well this passage would seem to line up very well with John 3:13. Back there in John 3, how many have gone into heaven? Just one. Now, David, would he have been a righteous man or an unrighteous man? All right, I think just about everybody would say, well, I mean, he had his faults like everybody else, but he definitely was someone who died in the right relationship with God. But now Peter, by inspiration, speaking for God, says David didn't what? He didn't ascend to heaven. Well, if he's still in existence somewhere and he didn't ascend into heaven, that would suggest since he's a righteous man, where's he got to be? I think he's got to be in paradise, that positive section of Hades. Then let's look at a third passage. This one comes from the book of John. It's found in Revelation chapter 6. We talked about this some time back, and this is one of the seals. As we looked at the seals, said that these seals deal with things that Christians face, things that the saved or God's people experience throughout the Christian life. Let's look at it and see what John says Christians face throughout the Christian dispensation. Revelation 6, verse 8. Who's got it? All right. Scott, we'll take you.
And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed with him.
Okay. A couple things about this passage. Once again, we're talking about the Christian era, what saved people experience, and he says they're going to experience the things associated with the pale horse. What's the first thing? Join with the pale horse. Death. Do Christians die? Yeah, we can point to the funeral services and the gravestones. I mean, God's people die. But John says not only do Christians die, as they die, what else is there?
Something follows.
Hades. Hades is also involved with the righteous. Now, there was a preacher, I don't remember the exact date, I'm thinking it was about 100 years ago, but a well-known preacher in the church, influential even to this day, he put out a book of sermons, and in one of those sermons, he talks about things related to the afterlife. Others, I'm sure, came up with this idea before him. But he espoused the idea that Hades, up until the time of Jesus, contained the righteous and the unrighteous, which nobody, I think, would have difficulty with. But his view was, after Jesus came, God left intact Hades. But the righteous people, according to this view, which I don't think is right, he says the righteous people were taken out of Hades and they were taken to heaven. Anybody ever hear that view? Okay. Well, you'll find that sometimes among people. It's still, even with some younger preachers today and some older preachers, it's still a popular idea. And as this fella, laid all that out, he challenged people. He said, I do not believe that you can find any passage in the Bible after Jesus came back from the dead that speaks of Hades in a positive light. And that was part of his proof for the idea that, well, Hades still exists, but now you've just got the wicked people there. Well, one of the difficulties with that is you don't have much information about Hades in the Bible. You have a handful of passages. So to say, well, the Bible never speaks about Hades in a positive light after the resurrection, you don't have much evidence, to work with. But I think he's wrong when you look at Revelation 6:8. The people John describes here are God's people, the saved. And he specifically says or associates two things with the saved: death and Hades. If the righteous don't go to Hades, then why associate this with them? And once again, this passage lines up very well with John 3, verse 13. No one has ascended into heaven except the one who came from there. In Acts 2:34, David was a righteous man, and even by the time of Pentecost, 1,000 years or so after his death, he still was not there. A couple of the passages. 1 John 4, verse 12. This is another passage that people, I think, are at least moderately familiar with, written by the same fellow who wrote the book of John, same fellow who wrote the book of Revelation. And now as he comes to the close of 1 John, this is what he says. 1 John 4, verse 12. Who'd like to be a reader? All right, Betty?
No man hath beheld God at any time. If we love one another, God abideth in us, and his love is perfected in us.
Okay, now this passage, people might try to explain it away in different ways. But still, when you look at it, John says, how many people have seen God? Nobody. Well, you would think if people have ascended into heaven, somebody would have gotten at least a little look at him. But John says, well, after the resurrection of Christ, not a single person has seen God. And then you have what we talked about earlier. We mentioned this last week. At the end of Revelation 15. Revelation 15, verse 8. He says, and the temple. Temple, of course, is going to be a reference to where God's presence is. The temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power. And how many? None. Not a single person was able to enter where? The temple. Until what? The seven plagues had been finished. Do you remember what we said several times about the seventh seal, the seventh trumpet, and the seventh plague? Seventh trumpet, seventh seal, seventh plague, they all are associated with what? Jesus' next and final return, the end of time. Now here John says, nobody is going to get to the temple until the seventh plague has taken place. Well, if that refers to the Lord's next and second coming, then that tells us that nobody, just like we have in John 3, verse 13, has gone to heaven. Now, as I said, we just need one passage to show that something is true. Here, I think you have at least five, and maybe we could pull out some more in the New Testament. But as we go through the book of Revelation, and we get these pictures, of souls under the altar, Revelation chapter 6, or we see some, elders worshiping back there in Revelation 4 and 5 and so forth. As I explained last week, or tried to explain, need to be very, very cautious about looking at these passages and saying this is what life in heaven is like. Because biblically, I find it very, very difficult to believe that people are there right now based on these texts. Anything that you want to add or ask over that? That's just something to keep in mind as we go through the book. Okay, some other things to look at from Revelation 15, verse 3. Moses' work as far as delivering the nation of Israel from Egyptian bondage. Would you say it was a great work? Yeah, I mean, it was certainly a mighty thing. But there is a greater deliverer. This, of course, is Jesus. He's involved with delivering people from the dragon, Satan, and his wicked helpers. Jesus delivers people from sin, plus the various things that the devil tries to stir up for them in life, as we see in Revelation chapter 15. Verses 2 and 3. These people came off victorious from the beast. Rather than do the will of Babylon, as people were doing, Revelation 14, verse 8, the ways of the world, God's people try to do his will. They try to honor him also as they go through their lives on this earth. And that's why we had that little discussion about whether we're talking about things in heaven or things on the earth. They're honoring God now by singing, if you will, the song of the Lamb, the song of Moses. And then in the middle of verse 3, you have a basis for the singing. John says, marvelous. Marvelous are the things that God has done. I had here a cross-reference, 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 3. That's also a passage that I'd like to have picked up. And then we'll also look at Ephesians 5, verse 19, as we're thinking about singing. Singing praises to God here on the earth. Let's get our helpers lined up. 2 Thessalonians 3, 3. Who'd like to take? All right, Harvey. And Lois, will you pick up for us the other passage, Ephesians 5, verse 19? 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 3. Harvey?
Lord is faithful, who shall establish you and keep you from evil.
Okay, the Lord is faithful. What's he going to do? He's going to establish you and he's going to keep you from evil. Well, if you have someone doing that for you, is that worthy of praise? Yeah, I mean, you want to honor someone who's involved in that kind of activity. That's precisely what we find in Revelation 15. God's marvelous activity in helping his people. As we've said before, the book of Revelation, it presents us with the same information that we have elsewhere in the New Testament, only it presents it in figurative terms. Then Lois, Ephesians 5, verse 19.
Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord.
Okay. Once again, this is a passage that we can relate very easily to Revelation 15. God's helping his people. And because of that help, not only when it comes to delivering people from sin, but the kind of help that Harvey read about in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 3, God deserves praise. Well, what kind of praise do we offer? Psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. The Bible tells us what kind of praise to offer. Well, is this information helpful as we look at our current culture? When people today think about honoring God, oftentimes what do they come up with as far as their idea, honoring God? Let's make worship fun. Let's make worship entertaining. Let's turn it into something like a circus. Well, that's not the picture. We want to honor God. We want to honor him in spirit and truth. And yet, sometimes as we look at our society today, we have a lot of people clamoring for fun songs. I like fun. Most of us here, I think, enjoy fun. But, you know, worship, it's to be a pleasant experience. It should be something that builds us up. But it is not designed to be a time of entertainment. Look carefully again at what we read in Revelation 15, 3 and 4. Think about it. They're God's people on the earth singing the song of Moses. That's a song about spiritual things, the deliverance that God had offered to his people. The servant of God, the song of the Lamb saying, great and marvelous are thy works. O Lord God, the Almighty, righteous and true are thy ways, thou King of the ages. Who shall not fear, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy, for all the nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy righteous acts have been made manifest. Now that seems like pretty lofty language. That seems like divine language, if you will. When you stack it up today, though, against some of the songs that people write, what do you find? Anybody looked at some of the modern, quote-unquote, Christian lyrics? Some of the songs that are being sung in some congregations? I'm not opposed to fast songs. I like fast songs. And I'm not opposed to, brief songs. Sometimes you have a song that's just one kind of stanza. But, you know, you get this kind of stuff going on. And people say, well, hey, you just kind of bring God down to our level. That's not the picture that we find in Revelation 15. The picture is that this worship on earth is to be a very, very serious matter. It's to be something that's very, very reverent. I would suggest that if people today who are involved with not only promoting these hymns, whether that's singing or whether that's using that in the local congregation, but the people, if they would come back and look at what the Bible describes as far as the kind of worship on earth, they'd be afraid to publish their material. They'd be ashamed. because it just does not match up. When we look at the book of Revelation and we see what's described about worship, not in heaven, but in this life, we find that the emphasis is God is great. God has done some marvelous works, and when it comes to his ways, they are righteous and true. This hymn, if you break it down, it talks about God. It praises God for his works, for his ways, his name, and his acts. Then John throws in a little something else. We'll see then if you've got some comments, and then pick up with verse 4. There are some times where Christians, as they go through life, may feel like they're getting a raw deal from God. Now, they may not always say that. They may not even acknowledge that to God, but sometimes that's how they feel. As we look at what we find here in Revelation 15, though, look at verse 3. It is 3. Great and marvelous are thy ways. And then as you move down a little bit, almighty. What else is said about God's ways? Works are first, and then ways. They're righteous and they're true. As God deals with people in the world, all people, but especially here his people, what's true about God's ways? As he deals with us, his dealings are always going to be righteous. We talked about last Sunday night, Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways, and that's so true. Last week, we looked at that from more of an academic standpoint as far as God's plan to redeem man. Tonight, I'm going to have a follow-up to that, but I'm going to look at that passage from a vastly different perspective. God's ways as far as some things associated with living the Christian life. And we may not always understand his ways. Sometimes we think that we may not get what we should, but God says my ways are always going to be correct. Then one other quick point, our praise to God should recognize him as king of what? King of the ages. Some translations, the King James, for example, might say king of the saints. There is a difference in our manuscript information here. Some prefer the ASV rendering King of the Ages, King of the Nations, but it's also true that God is certainly King of the Saints. Sometimes we look at the world and we think, well, the devil is really the one who's in control because it looks like his forces are so powerful. God, though, says what? You can rest assured that I am in charge. I'm the one who's truly king. Okay. A lot of stuff there about Revelation 15, but the key point is, as I said, I think we're dealing with a picture here of what worship should be like on the earth, not in heaven. Anybody want to contribute anything before we pick up with verse 4? Okay. In that fourth verse, some more information about this praise. Who shall not fear, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy, for all the nations shall come and worship before thee. For thy righteous acts have been made manifest. Now, this goes back to what Don was asking about earlier. If you go back and you look at this information, you can probably see that it's offset a little bit. Anybody have that offset type in the Bible? Verse 4? Okay, at least a handful of us do. Usually when you find that indented, that offset type, what's that telling you? Well, okay, it's added in. And it's usually a way of indicating this information is coming from elsewhere in the Bible. Pulling from, in this case, the Old Testament. Well, if you go back here and you look at this information, you don't find a single passage. John was quoting, and the translators recognize this, he was quoting the Old Testament. But to get this information, you've got to go back to multiple passages. You'd have to go back to Exodus 15, verse 11. You'd have to go back to Deuteronomy 32, verse 4. And you'd have to go back to Jeremiah 10, verse 7, and maybe three or four other passages to see where John is bringing all this information together from. So this is one, in a situation that just absolutely in line with what Don asked about. And it's one of the ways sometimes that the Bible writers taught things. All right, in constructing this information, John says that only God is holy. What will we associate with that word? God's holy. What's that mean?
Pure.
Okay, pure, sacred, religiously right. And when it comes to the unrighteous, what's true there? All right, they're not. So there has to be that separation. I may use this for a B&P tomorrow, but anybody see the note about the Pope? Said that atheists are going to be in heaven? Well, I guess I will use that for B&P tomorrow. So if you're on the B&P list, look for that. But yeah, he came out recently, Pope Francis, and said atheists are going to be in heaven. Well, now wait a minute. If God is holy, those folks that profess and live as atheists, they're not. So there can't be any joining. There can't be any fellowship or union there. And what else does he say? Because God's holy, how many should do something? All should fear it. Was that the quaking, shaking, trembling kind of fear? Okay. All right, it's the kind of fear that's respect. It's the reverential fear. We look at God, we know who he is, we know who we are. God's so great that who should recognize him as God? All nations. And that reminds us of what Jesus said, Matthew 28, verse 19, you go and you teach everybody. Because each one needs to have the chance to honor God and not only honor him, but they also need to glorify him, to worship him. And John also said that God's righteous acts have been made manifest. There's a lot of information that's been revealed about God. As you look at this information, we might miss some of the things that some of the people in the first century would have picked up on. And sometimes, it's the same kind of thing. We have various idioms in our culture. For example, somebody says, he's as dumb as a box of rocks. Well, okay, we've all heard that. We know what that means. I mean, not the brightest guy in the class and so forth. But you go to another country. You go over there to, for example, Africa, and you have that translated. Well, he's as smart as a box of rocks. What do you think they're going to think about that? Box of rocks? Well, that just doesn't compute. So sometimes, dependent on the culture, people will say different things, they'll have different idioms or different expressions that instantly convey some things. This seems to be one of those places. I'll give you this quote. He says, some of the most unique gods worshipped in this area, places like Laodicea, Philadelphia, Sardis, and so forth, were called holy and just. Now think about that. If you're in a culture where you're accustomed to hearing about gods, and these gods are referred to as holy and just, when John comes along and uses that same terminology, where does your mind go? Back there to the street corner, where you see one of those pagan gods that's identified or known as holy and just. He talks about a funeral inscription from the area involving holy and just, this pagan deity, to take vengeance on an individual if she does not return to the family some personal possessions left for safekeeping from the deceased. He also talks about a limestone pillar found in northeastern Asia. He says it depicts holy and just. And this particular image, he says, you've got the scales of justice on this hand, you've got the staff of authority on the other. When John comes along then and talks about the holy and just God, it's really a way of saying, okay, you've heard about that, but who is the one who's truly holy and just? It's the God of heaven. And as you live your life on earth, there is this holy and just God that is the living God, the true God. And as you're here on earth, what do you need to do? You bow before him, you praise him, you honor him, you serve him and not the false god that you find in your culture. Then the name of God, verse 4, that of course, as we've seen in other passages, would describe everything about God. His essence, his attributes, his works, his commandments, his promises. There's not a single thing about God that is unworthy of praise. Anything that you'd like to add or ask before we pick up with the verses that follow? Okay. Let's pick up with Revelation 15, 5 and 6. And after these things I saw, and the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony of heaven was open. And there came out from the temple the seven angels that had the seven plagues, the seven bowls of wrath, would be another way of describing this. They were arrayed with precious stone, pure and bright, and girt about their breasts with golden girdles. Verse 5 is another passage which I think helps us understand that John is not talking about praise in heaven. As we look at this information, we've got people living on the earth, and here's some of the things that are going to take place. He talks about the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven. Where would you say that describes? The temple of the tabernacle? Well, could be the church. But he says, and there came out from the temple the seven angels. When we add that detail, would we think that we're dealing with the church or maybe something else in this case? I think we're dealing with heaven. Have to look at this as the place where God is. I mean, God's everywhere, but there's that special presence of God, that full presence of God in the place that we know as heaven. If you go back to the Old Testament, you remember that the Hebrew people had something that was a tabernacle. That was that portable place of worship, and God's presence was there as Israel moved around a good bit. Well, that ultimately looked forward to the place that we know as heaven. And here it seems like John describes the full presence of God, if you will. One described this as the celestial depository where the very word of God is found, or God himself. The testimony As you go back to the Old Testament, let's look at Exodus 32, verse 15, because this is another symbol that as you go back and you try to find something as far as an Old Testament reference, it's going to help you a little bit to see what the point is in the book of Revelation. Exodus 32, verse 15. Let's see if we can figure out what the testimony was. All right, Scott's got it.
Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand. Tablets that were written on both sides, on the front and the back, they were written.
Okay. Testimony, Exodus 32, verse 15, what was it? Ten Commandments. Okay, very, very easy once we look at Exodus 32 to figure out what that was. What are those commandments? What did this testimony testify about? What did it prove?
Well, it proved that we have a true God and that He is laid out some rules for us to abide by so that we could get along together and be happy.
Excellent answer. This is, God says, the agreement for me, my testimony. All right, we know that that was true in the Old Testament. Now, John, looking at things from a New Testament perspective, talks about the testimony that came from heaven. Well, you think he's still talking about the Ten Commandments? Well?
No.
All right, we've got a new law. All right, so he uses that image from Exodus 32, but now we have a new agreement, which has also come from the living God. Well, if people are not willing to live under that agreement, and many are not, is that going to be a good thing or is that going to be a bad thing? It's going to be a bad thing. Well, if that's a bad thing, then as John prepares to describe the consequences of that, what would make sense? He says there are going to come some bowls of wrath. If you're not willing to hold to the new testimony, to God's new agreement, guess what? There are going to be some containers which dump on you. Now, are those containers going to dump on people in this life or in eternity? Think about how we've broken down the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and now the seven plagues. How many of the trumpets, seals, and plagues are associated with things in this life? The first six. Well, now as we look at the plagues, if you're not willing to hold to the testimony, John says, I'm going to give you six illustrations of things that you can expect to fall on you in life. And he's actually going to kind of group these by different people. Last week we had somebody talk about, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, the problem, false religion like Islam. Well, that's going to fall in here as far as one of the plagues. And if that's not enough for you, then John says if you're not willing to hold to these tablets of testimony, in addition to what you face in this life, what's going to be that final one that gets you at the end? Number seven. And it's interesting that when you have that number seven used, that's a symbol of completeness, fullness, perfection. If you don't experience enough of God's wrath and difficulty and hardship in this life because you've rejected His way, then when number seven comes along at the end of time, you're going to face the full consequences of John's wrath. Anything that you want to add or ask on that point? Okay. In 5b, the end of the verse here, John says, heaven was opened. Now, we've already seen some examples of this, and that's why I said you have some snapshots of heaven. Back in Revelation 11, verse 19, you have some information about heaven being opened. Back in Revelation 14, verse 17, you also have some information about heaven being opened. Now, in this particular case, heaven is open, and you have how many angels?
Seven.
Well, that number could be literal, or because it's seven, it also might be a number just to describe completeness, fullness. So, and maybe both senses are true here. But you have seven angels. They're coming from this place, and what do they have? They have seven plagues because the trumpets, the seals, they've already been dealt with. It's interesting to me that John doesn't say anything about human beings. Now, that may be for the reason that we gave earlier in the class, that people are not in the temple. They're not in the heaven right now. He's dealing with the Christian life as we look at the first six seals instead of the afterlife. When you think about John saying the doors of heaven were open today, why do you open doors? All right. Enter in or to? All right, to exit. Enter in, enter out. Either way. All right. Here in this particular case, you don't need anything to enter in. But for the people that are not following God's testimony, God says the doors are going to be open. Not so the unrighteous people can come in. We've already dealt with that. God's holy. Can't take those atheists and other people. But he opens up the door, so what? the plagues can come out. That anger, that wrath. The picture is that God is on the throne. He is definitely involved in his world. And some of his anger is going to be released on wicked people as they live their lives here on the earth. Some of those wicked people, of course, would be people who have persecuted God's people, Christians. And you see, if you look ahead a little bit to Revelation 16, verse 1, you can kind of get a sense of where we're headed. And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, go ye and pour out the seven bowls of the wrath of God, where? Into the earth. So there's a definite connection between the earth and the plagues that we read about here in Revelation 15 and Revelation chapter 16. By saying that these plagues come out of where? Heaven. What's that suggest about God's view of them? Does he approve or disapprove? He's not happy about it. I think that's the point. He's not happy that it has to go. But he's not opposed to it. When God is holy and just, that means that there has to be some consequences if people are not willing to do what's right. And here, they're going out with God's authority. Not that he wants people to be punished, but there are some cases where that does need to be done. Glenda?
I was just going to ask if we're entering into this part of the book where it's talking about the end of time. Does that mean that we are the church?
Give that question to me again. Are we entering into the period where... Let's go back and think about how John wrote in the book of 1 John and what we're seeing in the book of Revelation. And, you know, I know that this has got to be tiresome, but with those first seals that we read about, talks about the first six of Christian era, finishes it up seven steely at a time. And then he just kind of rewinds. If you can think about rewinding one of the old cassette tapes, that's what he does. And then he talks about the seven trumpets. First six throughout the Christian era, number seven, the end of time. Let's back up again, he says. Rewind it. And now we're dealing with the plagues, the bowls of wrath. And he's going to do what he did with the first two. He's going to say, first, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the Christian era. Bowl number 7, it's going to be the end of time. So he's saying the same thing as far as the periods of time. The Christian era, number 7, the end of time. But he's looking at this from different perspectives. In some cases, with the seals, for example, he's saying these things are faced by God's people. With the bowls of wrath, he's saying, okay, we're still dealing with the same period of time, but now the focus is going to be on the unsaved and what they experience. So with the seventh of each, you're dealing with the end of time, but with the first six, we're still dealing with the time period that started on the day of Pentecost and is going to continue up until the time that Jesus returns. And if we can get this fact in our minds, it's going to unlock about two-thirds of the book of Revelation. We may still struggle a little bit with some of the things and say, well, okay, we've got a bloody sea over here, what does that mean? And even if we struggle with that a bit, we still know that that's something that occurs during the Christian dispensation. And this, in my mind, is the key to unlocking the book of Revelation.
Is that where then everybody gets all this is going to happen on one day, on the end of the world, everything's going to... Instead of going back and looking at what you just described, like everybody thinks that it's going to be just one big boom.
Yeah, Armageddon. I think it's what, and we're going to see that in Revelation. I think it's Revelation 16. I believe it's verse 16. And that's what a lot of people will pull that information from.